Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Image Doctors, part of the Nikonians podcast series. This is episode number 57 for January 10th, 2008. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker, and Happy New Year.
That's right. Everyone had a safe and wonderful New Year's holiday, and hope everybody got what they wanted for under their respective trees or whatever it is that you put presents under these days, and hope the Nikon fairy came for everyone. So we've got a fun show for everyone again today. We're going to talk a little bit about locations that we like shooting.
Yeah, we had received a question from someone moving from Spain to the U.S. So they were wanting some ideas for good shooting locations within the U.S. So no international locations, at least from our perspective. These could be international for other people.
And we're going to do a sort of a mini review of the Nik ColorFX Pro 3 plug-in filters for Photoshop, which we've been able to get our hands on and try, and a little mini review on a new Gitso tripod, a traveler tripod, and we'll have our photo prescription as we usually do. So we'd like to start off this episode with talking about locations that we just like shooting. We've had the last few episodes have been pretty darn technical, very hardware oriented.
Yeah, so we got tired of that.
And as much as we can.
Yeah.
And so we thought we'd talk about places we like going, and we made it a sort of a short list of some of the top places we've enjoyed shooting. By no means is this a complete list, but we thought we'd start it off with a fun spot that you went to down in Texas a year or two ago.
Yeah, and that's Big Bend National Park. It's down in a fairly isolated portion of Texas, and it's not the quickest place to get to. People typically will fly into El Paso, Texas, or Midland, Odessa, and drive. So it's hours of driving to get there. And it's just out in the middle of nowhere. But that's what makes it a great place to shoot. There are great mountain formations, rock formations, things of that sort. Just big expanses of desert cactus. You get there at the right time of the year and you'll get blooms on those. But it's just a fantastic place, and you can be out there shooting, and there's no one around you at all. Good wildlife, too. It's not like going to Yellowstone or something like that where you just see it constantly. But I've seen bobcats, plenty of javelina, which is kind of like a variety of wild pig, also known as a peccary. You'll see roadrunners and lots of other bird life. It's a pretty good area for that. So
supposedly there's mountain lions there, too.
Yeah, mountain lions tend to be pretty bashful in general. Yeah,
they'll see you. You might not photograph them, but they're there.
Right.
Well, one of the places that I've enjoyed visiting the past couple of years is down in southwest Florida near Naples, Fort Myers area. Mm-hmm. And that's the Corkscrew Swamp, Corkscrew Swamp Audubon Bird Sanctuary. And it's really fun to go there. I think it costs, I don't know, $5 or $10 to get in, not too expensive. You make your donation to the Audubon Society. And what it really is a very large boardwalk over the swamp. And it starts off pretty dry, and then you get to some stuff that you would actually think is swamp as you get farther in. So there's alligators there. There's in the springtime, there's the warblers come through there, so you can see those. They'll have a few feeders up. A neat area in the back is called the lettuce fields. And it's kind of this swamp area, and then there's this floating bits of vegetation. Right. And almost always there's little blue herons out there. Sometimes there'll be alligators in there, and the alligators will be covered with these little bits of green stuff on them. And so you can do some real fun things. And of course, it's a big cypress. It's a cypress swamp. It's a challenging place to shoot, though. If you go there early in the morning when the birds are going to be most active, I've had a few times where I've been there where it's been very foggy, just in general. And then you're under a canopy in a swamp to begin with. So every time I have been there, I've used a flash for fill flash with a better beamer. The first time I went, I was shooting film, got some decent pictures. Second time I went, I had a D2X, did a little bit better. Yeah. I'm looking forward to going back with some of the new equipment where I can shoot at even higher ISOs.
Yeah. I've only been there once. It was actually based on a recommendation that you made, and my son and I were down in Florida at the Everglades, and we went up to that vicinity and really enjoyed it. The only problem that we had was, on the day that we were there, the lighting was kind of the opposite of what you were talking about. It was a little bit harsh and contrasty.
Oh, really?
Probably a little bit of overcast would have been good, mm-hmm. but great stuff.
Yeah, it's
nice
pretty fun.
Variety of birds. And
if you want to take pictures of cypress swamps, I mean, I was there and a deer came walking through, mm-hmm. you know, so there's all kinds of stuff to be seen.
It's
just, it just can be challenging light if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Moving down our list.
Yeah. Olympic National Park was a place I put on there, and I've been there several times. It's got a really nice, diverse set of subjects that you can shoot. Probably my favorite area is along the ocean. It's Olympic's got a long strip that's along the Washington coastline, and you'll see the stacks out there in the ocean, and you could do some pretty neat things with rocks close up, you know, shooting wide angle, things like that at sunset. And then it's got a rainforest area, which is not exactly a common thing within the 48 states, at least, and mountainous areas, you know, so you can have wildlife in those sorts of places. It's got nice waterfalls.
It's a huge park.
It's a very large park, but very cool place.
And that's near, I guess you'd fly into Seattle
mm-hmm.
to go there. That's probably the...
Yeah, and it's a few hours drive.
Where you went. And it's just a huge park. You'd want to spend a few days there. I never spent serious time there, but I did drive through once. Mm-hmm. And on that drive, just down the coast, I think in one afternoon, I saw 7 bald eagles.
Yeah.
Just from the car.
Yeah.
I, you know, didn't have the camera, but it didn't matter. It was cool to see them anyway.
Yeah. It's a great place.
I'd like to go back.
Yeah. At least at this point in time, I'm planning to go back there with my wife in 2008.
Cool.
Trip. So
very good.
Looking forward to it.
Now moving back to Florida, which is where I'm from originally. So I've had a little more experience going to some of these places. The two places that are very similar in Florida, you know, if you're going to Florida, a lot of times it's to see birds. So one is the Everglades, of course, but my favorite and a little closer to where I live or where I went to, you know, where I grew up was, is the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, right by Cape Canaveral.
Right.
So the town is Titusville, but if you wanted to fly there, you'd probably just fly into Orlando. And from Orlando, it's about an hour and a half, maybe less of a drive. And what I like about the Merritt Island, wildlife refuge is that it's there's a large estuary. It's very open, and it's a wildlife loop drive that you can just go around in your car. And a lot of times you can just shoot right from your car if you have a beanbag or something and you want to shoot birds. But you can get out and walk around too with a tripod. What I love about it is that it's got so much space that you never feel claustrophobic. You can have 10 photographers shooting in the same area. Although I've never run into that situation there where you're elbow to elbow with people and there's enough space that everybody can spread out.
Mm-hmm.
You can get nice, bright, sunny conditions early in the morning. You can get good reflections off the water in the flats there. You'll see alligators, you'll see green herons, all of the, you know, the great blue herons, all of the things you might expect to see in Florida. And it's so easy to deal with and just drive around. And so close to Orlando that it's a really fun destination.
Mm-hmm.
And I prefer it over some of the other places that I've been to in Florida for doing birding, just because it's not crowded.
Right.
And some of the really popular spots just, I mean, you're just elbow to elbow with people to get into a tiny little space where you can see through the mangroves to get, you know, to see across. I've seen spoonbills there.
Me too.
Lots of other stuff. So it's a good place to go and I highly recommend it. And I don't think there's an admission charge to get in.
No,
I think it's free. So that's always, the price is right.
Yeah, I sure enjoyed it.
And since you can just drive to wherever you need to go, it's really easy if you have big lenses because you're not hiking them around
mm-hmm.
like you might some other places.
Yep. All right. Next on the list is Denali National Park up in Alaska. And I probably could have just generalized it and said Alaska because it's a fabulous place as a whole, but Denali in particular is one of my favorite areas. And incidentally, there's an adjacent state park, Denali State Park, that also includes some great locations. So I wouldn't limit it just to the national park boundary. But it's a gorgeous area. You can shoot landscapes, you know, great wildlife up there. Although, you know, one of the challenges is that you know, unlike a lot of the other national parks, there are a lot of restrictions placed on private vehicles. And so, you know, during the peak season, at least, you can't just drive in there in your car. You have to take buses in and things like that. But they'll let you out wherever you want to get out. You can get out and traipse all over the place. There really aren't footpaths in Denali, so you can go everywhere, including, you know, running into grizzly bears. But it's
try to avoid that.
Yeah, try to avoid that. Beautiful place, you know, really spectacular, huge expanses. The last time I went there was during its autumn, which was late August, beginning of September. It was very early just because of the northern latitude. And it was just absolutely gorgeous. You know, oranges and yellows mixed with greens, reds, very intense, you know, on the tundra and stuff. But go there if you get a chance. You won't regret
it. It's on my list. I haven't been there yet.
Yeah, you got to go.
I definitely do. Now, another place I used to live was California. Mm-hmm. California's got a couple of good places, but one of the ones that's really fun to go to is Joshua Tree National Park. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It's in the high desert. It's near Los Angeles, but actually it's closer to sort of between Riverside, San Bernardino, and mm-hmm. Palm Springs. It's out right. east. You know, it's a pretty good way. If you're in Los Angeles, to get to Joshua Tree is probably about 3 hours worth of driving, I would say. From somewhere like Riverside, I want to say it took us about an hour and a half to 2 hours to drive out there. And I've been out there for other things. You can go rock climbing. It's a great place to go rock climbing if you're into that. But lots of granite, salt and pepper granite formations. And then, of course, the signature Mojave Desert species, which is the Joshua Tree, which, of course, made famous on a U2 album cover. Mm-hmm. But those funky-looking trees, which are a yucca, I believe. They're a form of species of in the yucca family. And Joshua Tree, because it's out in the desert in California, it's got really clear air. It's one of those places where skies are always blue. Mm-hmm. You know, a polarizer can even be too much sometimes. And you can get those really high contrast images that just pop. And especially in the evening at sunrise or dusk, you can get some really awesome pictures of Joshua Trees with just stars behind them if you do it at night, or all kinds of stuff. And then there's wildlife there too. You can see desert tortoises and jackrabbits and those sort and lizards and that sort of thing. But mostly Joshua Tree, you're going to go there, you're going to see you know, just cool rock formations, just very exotic, kind of like being on the moon, and these interesting plants.
Yeah, it's a fun place. The last time I was there, my son and I were photographing there, and we had the single most intense sunset I've ever seen in my life, probably because of pollution in L.A.
Probably.
But
it's good for something.
It is good for some things. But it was just an incredible red, and it was the kind of thing where, you know, sometimes you never know what's going to happen with light, and, you know, we had a lot of clouds and things like that, and it looked like we weren't going to get anything at all in the way of a sunset. You know, just maybe a little brief thing. We actually started packing up, and then all of a sudden it popped out, and it just went to this most incredible color.
It pumped up the red channel.
It was unbelievable. And like I said, it was the most intense sunset I've ever seen. So we got some cool shots of the Joshua Trees silhouetted against the sky and rocks and things like that. So
it's also just nice a great place. Spot for astrophotography.
I bet.
If you're into that, because it's one of those few places in Southern California that's far enough away from most of the lights. When the Hale-Bopp comet was coming through, which I think was 98, mm-hmm. maybe, that was a spot where a lot of people went out to photograph it. Mm-hmm. So if you're into that kind of thing, it can be fun to do that.
Yeah, it was funny on the trip that where we photographed Joshua Tree, we were actually primarily in Death Valley, which is another good spot too. And we weren't planning on going to Joshua Tree. But what happened to us is it was early January and it got really cold in Death Valley. There was snow and everything and it was kind of overcast. And we had several days of that. And we thought, you know, we're not getting a lot of new stuff at this point. And Joshua Tree wasn't that far away and looked like the weather was going to be okay. So we ran down there and ended up staying in, what is it, 1,000 palms?
29 palms. No,
29 palms.
29 palms is where the Marine base is.
Yeah.
I think there's a town of Joshua Tree. It's pretty much not much out there.
We stayed right by there.
Yeah.
And it was
barren.
Just a very pleasant surprise. Yeah, we really enjoyed it.
Well, let's see. Moving to Utah.
Mm-hmm. I had put down Canyonlands National Park, and kind of like with Alaska, you could just put down the state of Utah because there are a lot of other great locations too. But I particularly like Canyonlands. One of the reasons for that is it's a very large area, And if you like photographing the Southwest, it's got a lot of diversity in terms of the rock formations. Arches National Park is nearby, and it's great too, but one of the problems is that it's almost overdone. And you'll see the same shots of, you know, really famous arches a lot of the times. And that doesn't mean you won't want to do them yourself, but with Canyonlands, I always got the feeling that I was doing something new a little bit more often. And very expansive. You can go back there and you're just kind of by yourself, as opposed to in Arches where there's usually a bunch of cars in a parking lot right by you. So that would be high on my list, and especially if you have a four-wheel drive vehicle or access to one, it's a great place, because then you could really get into more isolated areas.
Neat. And that's not too far from Colorado.
No.
It's not too bad at all. Well, the last one I got on my list was another California spot, which I went to, 7 or 8 years ago. It's the Anza Borrego Desert State Park. It's a California state park, and it's really out in the middle of nowhere. It's out past the Salton Sea, sort of down east of San Diego, a little bit, so you're out in the desert, really. There's not a lot out there. There's a bunch of the nearest towns, if you were going to fly there, you'd probably want to fly to San Diego or Palm Springs or something and get start from there. But you're going to have a little bit of a drive because it's on the other side of the coastal range. There's a lot of little farming towns in there, a lot of reclaimed water from the Salton Sea, a lot of agricultural industry. But then you get out to this state park, and if you go there in the spring, if California's had a wet spring, and by spring I mean there, you're probably talking about like in the March time frame, March, April, the wildflowers will bloom there and they will go crazy. And you'll just see these expensive mats of pink wildflowers all, and then mountain range behind you and sand. And it's neat and it's real fun. And you can do a lot of stuff out there, but it's remote. Bring water. It's hot.
Yeah.
Even in the springtime, it can be fairly warm down there. But if you get there when the wildflowers are going on, it's really neat, because you just don't think of the desert. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is not something that's teeming with life, but then to get all those colors coming out, mm-hmm. Is a real fun thing. And, again, real, real clean air. So, easy to overpolarize.
Yeah.
You can get, you gotta be a little bit careful of that, but it's very fun. And then, there's some scenic drives on your way out that you can do as well, just going through the little mountain towns. So mm-hmm. it can be pretty fun. Mm-hmm. So that's by no means is this an exhaustive list of what we like. I mean, there's lots of places that we like, but those are some that, we've gone back to, where we frequented over the years, where it's like stuck out in our mind.
Yeah, and at least for me, I would go back again to mm-hmm. all of those places.
Exactly.
And then again after that. There's just a lot to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so hopefully that satisfies at least piques people's interest in finding some places to shoot at around here. If you're coming to visit the United States, you want to think about a place to go. Mm-hmm. That'd be at least a starter.
Just don't put them all on your list.
No, it's hard. And then, keep in mind time of year.
Yeah.
So some places do better at certain times of year than others.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Next topic.
We want to move on to talking about the new ColorFX Pro 3 filter set. Mm-hmm. And this is from Nick Software. Mm-hmm. And it was just released for Photoshop not that long ago, a couple of months ago maybe.
Right.
And it's actually pretty nice. I mean, ColorFX Pro ColorFX filter set has been around for a while in different forms. And this is their newest version. And with it, they've done a few things to the interface to make it better, and they got a few cool new features and how it works. But let's start with just an overview of what the ColorFX filters are, because I think that's really, why would someone be interested in these?
Yeah.
And they kind of fall into two categories, the ColorFX filters. They have some filters that are, you can think of as traditional photographic filters. Things like neutral density graduated filter, polarizer, skylight filter. Then they have other ones that are absolutely create special effects.
Yeah, the Zowie kind of things.
And so to be honest, Rick and I shoot similar kinds of stuff. And so we don't use the full slate of these filters by any means, because there's some that are
not even close.
There's some that are just quite pop art.
Right.
But then there's other ones that it has, and it implements them in a very nice, tasteful way and can be very easy for certain effects, like the graduated filters. Mm-hmm. That's a real easy effect. Black and white conversions does a very good job of black and white conversions. And one nice thing in this new ColorFX Pro 3 is the film effects. Mm-hmm. So it has presets, kind of like what we talked about previously with the alien skin
exposure program. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you can go in here. And now what's nice is that this works in Photoshop, and sort of an overview of the interface, I guess. When you launch the filter, you get a large window pops up, and you have on the left-hand side, you can select any of the filters that you want. So you're not locked into the initial selection that you choose. You know, if you click on a filter from a palette, you can change.
Incidentally, if you go to the Nix Software website, you'll find out that they have several versions of ColorFX.
Oh, that's true.
And that just varies the quantities of filters that you're getting. Everything from a smaller set, and it's a less expensive package, to the complete one, and that's what we were looking at, that includes all of their effects. So you'll want to take a look at some of the tables that they have on their website and see what's included in each one. You can download a trial version and see which ones you prefer, and you make your selection based on that. The price changes accordingly.
Right.
If you're working in U.S. dollars, it ranges from $99.95 for what they call the standard edition with 15 filters, up to just about $300 for the complete edition that has 52 filters. So pretty good difference in terms of price and quantities of filters. But going back to what it looks like when you open up, they've redone the interface.
It's really quite nice.
Yeah, it is. I would love to see this used in NX in the future. It's a one of the trends lately is using the nice darker shades on
neutral gray backgrounds.
Right. And so it's very good. A little bit darker kind of look, which accentuates the look of the photo and makes it a little bit easier to edit. And all the controls and everything work nicely. It's got, for all of the filter effects, quite a variety of options, with some of them being fairly powerful in terms of the adjustments that you can make.
Some of them being fairly weird in terms of the adjustments
you
can make.
Turned on one that's called Detail Stylizer, and wow.
And it's kind of like a posterization kind of effect, and
it's not subtle.
No, not at all. But what's really neat with these filters, and this is the biggest difference, I think, with the 3.0 edition, and that is, you get in the controls, which is on the right-hand side, you get, in addition to the filter controls, so like right now I'm looking at black and white conversion, and you have the same thing where you can control a color filter and the contrast, and the typical controls that you might get. You have control point technology in this filter. Mm-hmm. And the way the control points work is to define selections. And they work kind of like the control points we've talked about in Capture NX. And there's two. There's a plus control point and then a minus control point. And they work like you might think. If you put a minus control point on a part of your image, the effect will be removed from those pixels that have similar values. And the opposite occurs with the plus control point. Mm-hmm. In addition, because this operates in a Photoshop plugin, you can click a button that says brush, and then what it'll do is it'll apply the filter it'll automatically create the filter in a new layer in Photoshop with a layer mask, and then it gives you the brush tool so you can paint in the effect where you choose. Mm-hmm. Or you could just apply it to the entire image.
Right. In which case it will still show up as a layer in Photoshop, which is a very nice thing.
Right.
That way you can later change the opacity if you want and make
or get rid of it.
Filter stronger or weaker or yeah.
Get you know, rid so of it's it a non-destructive way. Filter set because right. It creates things in a layer. Another nice feature in the interface is something called quick save slots. And so if you've just dialed in a nice little preset, you've maybe tweaked something to your liking, you can just quickly add in up to four presets for each of the filters. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty nice, so that you can save those things, and they're readily accessible right there from the menu. So it works very well.
Now, in terms of the actual filters, What I thought we might do is talk a little bit about some of the ones that, we liked in particular, and I think we had a fairly similar reaction to them.
Right.
What you really need to do, though, is download the trial and just see what you think. You know, see what you might find useful or not.
Right. Most of the ones that we like are in the when you're in the filter, are in the traditional tab.
That's because we're boring.
That's right. But these are traditional kinds of effects that you might otherwise get with real filters on your camera.
Right.
So these are things like graduated filters, infrared film, skylight filters. There's a polarizer filter. It gives a polarizer effect. And these are things that you might be able to do on your own with other products or just in Photoshop. But it's kind of nice just to be able to click that and have a slider just to get that effect the way you want.
Yeah.
And so one of the ones that we like is, for example, the skylight filter, which gives that sort of UV warm. It just warms up the image just a little bit.
Yeah, it's a fairly subtle thing.
It does exactly what it sort of described.
Mm-hmm. Sunshine is a stronger version of that, and where I found that it works well is if you're in a situation where you've got heavily overcast lighting, you know, that really dull stuff where the shadows just all disappear and it becomes kind of bluish. And using the sunshine filter in that situation can work remarkably well. If you try it in bright light, it'll look just completely overdone.
Right. But then within some of these filters, there's different kinds of effects that you can apply. I mean, you can vary the color effect mm-hmm. or the intensity of it. Not just sliders. There's these little presets, and they'll give you slightly different different looks depending on what you want. Another one that we kind of like is one called... it's in the landscape bin, and it's called foliage. And this is kind of like what you described as instant autumn.
Yeah.
If you want to make your trees look like they have yellow leaves, even when they don't, this is a way to enhance that. When they're green. That's right. This is a way to do that. And again, you can have, you know, a couple different variants on the color, you know, if you want it more orange or more greenish.
You can turn autumn into summer, too.
That's right.
So it'll do some fairly crazy things, and the filters work very well. It's not something I would do. But
it's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I could see someone that, you know, had to get a shoot in, you know, certain kind of look would find it useful. It does work remarkably well. The thing, I would just always be bugged by it because I would know it really wasn't that time of year, but
right.
The effect works quite well. And it's also got a thing called Indian Summer that does
it's it. Even more intense.
Yeah. Similar concept, but
yeah, and then you get the real red kind of foliage. Foliage sort of enhances yellows and greens. The Indian Summer makes things turn red.
Right.
So that's a completely different look. And it leaves the skies alone. And again, if you do it right and, you know, you're looking for a, you know, an interesting effect. You know, like I said, we wouldn't do this,
you know,
with a normal
probably
pictures.
Wouldn't even know. I mean,
right.
It does work that well, but mm-hmm. I would always know, so
right.
It would bug me.
But if you were kind of shooting something where you needed to get that look and it wasn't that time of year, mm-hmm. maybe for some kind of assignment, well, yeah. That's a way to do it.
Yeah.
Now, if you're into portraits...
Some really nice stuff.
There's some very nice stuff. Starting with, there's one that's just... a classical soft focus effect, mm-hmm. which can work very nicely.
And that one is a lot like putting a diffusion filter on your camera lens. So it's just going to soften everything up,
mm-hmm.
eliminate, you know, blemishes on the face and things, but it'll do everything, including the hair and stuff like that.
Right. It just softens the whole, mm-hmm. the whole image. Unless, of course, you apply it selectively with the brush or
right.
control point.
Right. Now, there's a filter called the dynamic skin softener, which is quite cool. And the way it works is you'll bring up the image, and then it's got a little eyedropper control, and you'll put it on a patch of skin. And what it does is, based on that color or general range of colors, it'll soften up the area there. So again, you know, for a portrait, especially of a woman, it's extremely nice. Just gives a very good look to the image, but it won't diffuse the hair.
Right.
So you'll get soft skin tones with sharp looking hair, and you can dial in the strength of it to vary it, and it can look pretty natural or it can look pretty strong. Just up to you.
Mm-hmm. You can get rid of blemishes with it just without having to do a lot of cloning work. So it's pretty nice.
And then there's a stronger version of diffusion, et cetera, for portraits. And that one is called Glamour Glow. And it does, you know, some blurring to the image, that same diffusion. It'll add in some warmth. And what it does is it creates kind of a retro look for portraits, the way that portraits were often done of Hollywood stars in the 40s and 50s. And again, a very nice, tasteful look that you can vary using the opacity type of settings. So I thought those worked very, very well. I could see a wedding photographer just absolutely loving those.
Yeah, I mean, there's if you do the kinds of photos that would benefit from a lot of this kinds of post-processing, mm-hmm. then this is an excellent filter pack.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially if you get the Pro, which has got pretty much everything in there, or the Complete Edition, I should say, mm-hmm. got just about everything in there that you can possibly imagine, including some really bizarre stuff, you know, like cross-processing things. You can do, you know, there's an interesting one called Polaroid Transfer. Mm-hmm. And this is something my grandmother actually does, or she did. You can get a Polaroid film, and there was a way to take the emulsion off the film and then transfer it onto a piece of paper. And of course, the edges are all crinkly because it's mm-hmm. this emulsion. You do it in water or something, and I have no idea how you do it. And then the image itself just, you know, you don't get a lot of fine detail. It looks, because it's almost just the colors that are coming through. Mm-hmm. And this filter will do that, and it'll apply that kind of weird torn edge to the edge of the image, and it's kind of neat.
It's a very cool look.
So there's a lot of stylistic stuff that we often don't get into because that's just not what we do. We tend to have images when we post-process them that look, you know, natural, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you can't come across a lot of uses for some of these filters, especially if you're doing commercial photography or any kind of stuff like that where you might be going for a particular look.
Yeah. And, like I was saying, I think wedding photographers could have a blast mm-hmm. with a lot of the filters
in
here. I think
so. So was there anything else on that filter that we wanted to discuss or on the set?
I think that's it. You know, there is a version for NX. It's called 2.0.
It was the previous one. And it works.
Yeah, it works very well. It does not have the control point features yet, but, you know, maybe that'll show up in a future version.
Right. But what it does do is it applies the filters as an edit step in your edit list, mm-hmm. so you can still use the brush tools and any of the other selection tools that you might want mm-hmm. That you'd be using in Capture NX.
Right.
So that's available. And all of these are available from the Nick Software website, which is www.nicksoftware.com.
And again, you know, take a look at the trials.
Mm-hmm. It's the best way to do it.
Yeah, that's the only way that works, really. All right. We've got, courtesy of our friends at Gitso, a Gitso Traveler tripod. The specific model is the GT1550T.
And it's tiny.
It's tiny. It's remarkable. It's just a little over a foot long when folded up. And it's a very clever kind of tripod, the way it works. The center column actually ends up nestling down inside the legs when you fold it all up, so you get a very compact size, you know, several inches shorter than you would with a traditional type of tripod. It's a bit difficult to describe verbally.
Yeah, the legs actually fold up 180 degrees.
Yeah.
So when it's compact, it's truly compact. And then it's got about a 12 or 14 inch center column. Mm-hmm. And this particular model came with its own little mini ball head, right?
Right.
So you can use a traditional
type of mount on it. At some point, we're going to have to try one of the little Markins ball heads that has the Arca Swiss type of quick release on it.
And this is what, five sections?
It's five sections.
And it's carbon fiber 6X. It's
right.
Got the new leg locks. Is that correct?
Yeah, a variant on them. I think it's a slightly different design than the normal ones you find on 6X tripods, although you'd never know it. Working with them, it seems to work the same way.
Now, when you extend this thing, this actually gets to be almost a full-size tripod. I mean, it's
yeah,
you know, it's about 4 feet tall without the center column.
Yeah, and when you raise it up, stuff, it's a pretty decent height. So
the scary thing is that look how thin those ends are.
Yeah, it's got very skinny little sections, you know, at the bottom. And at first glance, you would think, oh my God, this thing is going to flex so much that it's not going to be usable. And what's very surprising is it doesn't. It's incredibly stiff for something of its size. So with the initial photos I've taken, it worked pretty well. It's not the kind of tripod where you're going to put a D3 and a 200 to 400 zoom on it. That's just well over its capacity. But you could certainly put a D3 on it and, you know, a smaller size lens is more in the normal kind of range and do just fine.
Yeah, it's surprisingly rigid.
Yeah, it's remarkable when you grab one of the legs, try to bend it. It doesn't really bend very much at all.
It's also got an integrated little hook underneath. Mm-hmm. So you could put a little, you know, weight on there if you wanted to. I don't know if you'd need to, but it's got the little hook.
Probably wouldn't hurt. Wouldn't hurt.
Just depending on what kind of load you're putting on this, because I don't remember. What's the exact capacity, do you remember, approximately, what this one is rated to?
It's rated around 4.5 kilograms, so, you know, around 10 pounds or so.
That's not bad.
No, that's not bad at all. With most tripods, you actually want to go a little bit lighter than the rated weight.
But you could easily put a D300 and a good lens on that.
Yeah, like a 70 to 200 or a 300 perhaps. Now, the best way to find out how one of these travel tripods works is take it somewhere. So that's what I'm going to do.
Where are you going?
Well, actually, at the time people listen to this podcast, I'll theoretically be in the Galapagos Islands.
Cool. Now I'm jealous.
Yeah. So
that should be fun.
My family and I are doing a trip down to Ecuador, and we'll spend some time on the mainland part of Ecuador at the beginning, at the end, and do some things around Quito and go to a cloud forest area and things like that.
So I know what we'll be talking about probably in the next episode.
You probably do.
That'll be great.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I wanted to get the D3 and D300 when I did was for this specific trip. So,
and you are lucky.
We'll talk a little bit about how those cameras work there, and we'll talk about the Gitzo tripod.
Right. Now, this tripod, I'm looking at this. I just looked it up on the B&H website. It's not cheap.
No, it's not cheap.
It's like, over $600 US. So it's really expensive. So it better be rigid.
Yeah.
For something like that. But, you know, Gitzo makes a couple of different kinds of tripods. They make the tabletop ones, which are about the same size folded up, but they don't extend nearly as far. You know, they only go up about, you know, 24 inches or 30 inches or something. So this is an option if you want to have essentially a full height tripod or nearly a full height tripod that folds down into something that you could pretty much carry with you in any kind of carry-on bag on your luggage or whatever. And it's very light too.
Yeah. More importantly, if you're hiking around a city or an area where you don't really want something large, this looks like it would be a really nice option.
And it comes in a little bag so you can have that. Well, that's cool.
I'm going to find out.
Thanks to our friends at Bogan Imaging, I believe, who sent us this. They're distributors of Gitzo, so we appreciate that. They carry all of the good stuff, you know. Well, that pretty much brings us to our last thing of this episode. But before we get to our photo prescription, I have an announcement from the Nikonians community. If you've been checking the news blog, you'll know that HP is offering 3 high-quality prints for all Nikonian Silver, Gold, and Platinum members. And these are up to 13 by 19 inches in size and produced on the HP B9180 printer that Rick and I reviewed earlier. So head on over to blog.nikonians.org and click on the article that was December 20th, 2007, and you can get all the details plus the links to get your 3 free photo prints. And one cool thing about this offer is you get a choice of trying out 3 of the different HP papers, the Artist Matte Canvas, the Professional Satin Photo Paper, as well as the Smooth Fine Art Paper. And you can print them with a border or borderless. So it's a great deal for all of our Silver, Gold, and Platinum Nikonians. And so that brings us to our photo prescription for this week. This is less of a prescription this time. It's more just something fun that I came across and wanted to share with everybody. Mm-hmm. And so this is mostly applicable to our U.S. listeners. Really, it's only applicable to our U.S. listeners, but it's really neat. And that's making your own photo stamps or postage stamps. And if you go to stamps.com, which is a website. They're a service that, and I've heard of them before. They are mostly for small businesses. They would allow you, they have a way to allow you to print your own postage. But they also have a photo stamp service, and the website for that is called is at photo.stamps.com. And if you go there, they have a little utility. You can upload an image, a JPEG that you've taken, and they will print you a page of U.S. postage stamps with your photo on it. Mm-hmm. And you can get this in a range of denominations. The standard U.S. postage right now for first-class letter is 41 cents. And I thought this would be something worthy of trying. So I did. I sent off an order for those, and they came back about a week later. I got my stamps, and they look pretty darn good. And I'm going to be using this more, I think, for postage with our new baby. So we'll have some posters of Joseph on there, some stamps of Joseph to send to relatives. I think they'd get a kick out of that. But it lets you choose the color of the stamp, the background. And then you have a little JPEG image in there. And if you're on a Mac, I think there's actually a utility you can download that'll directly connect you to the stamps.com website when you're done. It links right into to your computer's iPhoto library or any other directory that you choose. And if you're a PC user, I think you just do it on the online form. You expect to pay probably double on the postage that you would pay otherwise for just plain postage. But how cool is it to have your own picture on a stamp?
Right. And there are several ways that you could do it. I mean, the application that you were mentioning, New Baby Photos, you know, great idea for both letters that you're sending, or they make really nice gifts for the grandparents or other family relatives. Mm-hmm. If you have your own business, you could choose to use them for some of your mailings to clients and have one of your own images. There are just a large number of things that you
right.
can do.
And what's very nice, too, is that the minimum order is just a single page of 20 stamps. Yeah. So you're not going to – and for that, you'd probably pay about a dollar a piece. So it's about $20 U.S. for 20 stamps. Yeah. And it goes down a little bit as you increase the order. So but it's neat. Yeah. And it's just one of those things that I had no idea you could have your own images on legal U.S. postage. Right. But here's a way to do it.
And it's certainly possible that it exists in other countries as well. We just didn't get a chance to do a search. But maybe take a look. You never know.
Well, that brings us to the end of another exciting episode here at the Image Doctors. We thank everyone again for joining us.
Yeah. And as always, we appreciate the feedback that's done on podcastalley.com. You can get to that just from the link on our webpage for these podcasts.
Right. And don't forget, if you do have a question, send us an email. We're available. We do answer all the emails we get at podcasts@nikonians.org. And so look for us there on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we will see you in another 2 weeks.
Yep. Bye-bye.